This audio tape is copyrighted by Uplift Ministries to maintain the integrity of the material. Permission is granted to make copies of this tape in its entirety as long as this message is included. Additional resources may be obtained from Uplift Ministries by calling 1-800-952-2382.
It's appointed unto a man to die and thereafter the judgment. And part of that judgment will be in relation, if we understand the parable of the talents correctly, will be in regard to our stewardship. I looked at Psalm 17 some months ago, and I saw there a tremendous distinction between what people of the world do and what Christians might do. What differentiates you in your estate planning from someone in the world in their estate planning? We use, because of the legal structure that we live in, we generally use most of the same tools. So what differentiates a Christian from a non-Christian when it comes to estate planning? And I found this interesting that David says that, speaking of the people of the world, they are satisfied with children and leave the rest of their substance for their babes or for their children. As for me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness. The world, the people of the world, will generally leave everything to their children. And they have, they're satisfied in this life with all the material wealth. There is real no satisfaction, we know that, but that's what they feel is satisfaction, and they leave everything to their children. But the Lord's people will also take into account the Lord's work in their stewardship planning, in estate planning. And then finally, the third portion of scripture here is about the rich farmer who indicated that he had had such a wonderful crop that year, he was going to tear down his existing barns and build greater barns, and then he was going to put his feet up and go into retirement and enjoy himself. But God said to him, "You fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided?" So when your life is over, whose things, then whose will those things be that you have accumulated or provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. I believe that it is incumbent upon us as believers to be good stewards in this final act of stewardship in planning our estates here. And we have a golden verse that we use that's from Proverbs that says, "Honor the Lord with thy substance." I'm going to try and use this remote. If not, my able assistant, Drew, will help me, and it looks as though it's not working, Drew, at this moment. We'll keep going on it. Most of us think that we don't have estates. You know, when we think of an estate, we're generally talking about what maybe Sam Walton left behind. They had an estate. We don't have an estate. Well, I've got good news for you today. You've not just got one estate, you've got two estates. And we see that, first of all, you have a gross estate, a total gross estate. And in that total gross estate is life insurance and jointly owned property and anything that you've put into a lifetime trust, which we refer to as a revocable or revocable trust. Revocable in that you can revoke it, that you can change it, you can amend it at any time. You have a total gross estate, and you have a probate estate, an estate that will be subject to probate in the county, in the state in which you live. Almost without exception, there are some measures of probate for your will, for those things that are in your will. You have personal possessions, that you have stocks and bonds that are registered in your name, and you have real property and maybe some business interests. So you really have two estates. One that goes through probate, which is an administration to make sure that there is correct settlement of your estate in terms of your will, and we'll be discussing some features of that shortly. And then there's the total gross estate where some of your assets, like life insurance, if you've nominated a beneficiary, that will bypass probate and go directly to your beneficiary. Same with jointly owned property. It will automatically bypass probate and go to the other person that is on the title. We want to invite you to consider having a will. People who have analyzed and surveyed have come up with a conclusion that over 70% of the people who die in the United States die without a will. And that includes lawyers and accountants and estate planners. Because, you know what, we don't feel we're going to die. We're immortal, and we're going to put it off, and we put it off, and we put it off. And so maybe one day we'll get round to it. You see, if I have everything in order, then it's time for me to die, isn't it? I mean, that's my thinking. If I've got everything in order, then the Lord will take me home. And I don't want to go home yet. I still want to enjoy. I want to cling on to this life. That's the human response. And why have a will? Well, for disposal of our property in all its shapes and forms and all its titles at death. We're going to dispose of it through our will. We're going to avoid intestacy. Intestacy just simply means dying without a will. So the fact of the matter is, most states have laws of intestacy, so that if you die without a will, the laws of that state will determine who gets your assets, and you may not like what they say. So you do have a will. The state has made a will for you. You want to nominate your executors, your guardians, your trustees of your choice. If you don't, the state will. So that's why you need a will. You want to perhaps establish trust to protect your beneficiaries. Maybe you have some relatives or some friends that you really don't want to give them a large sum of money up front. You want to give it to them over time. Maybe you never want to give them the principal. You only want to give them the interest. You should do that through a trust. And also, you can, in order to avoid federal estate taxes, you want to establish trust for that. You want to minimize death taxes and other costs through a trust, through a will, and from the will, you give birth to a trust. What must an executor do? And maybe you all have will right now. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. Maybe 70% of you won't put your hand up. But you've nominated maybe a family friend or a confidant or someone who you can have confided in or whom you can trust as the executor of your will. What must he do? I want you to understand the process of all the things that he has to do. It's not an easy appointment. Don't just appoint any old person. Understand what he has to do for you. He's got to probate your will. He's got to submit it to the court. He's got to assemble and safeguard your assets. He must know where they are and how to handle them. He must manage your investments temporarily. He's now in the capacity of a fiduciary, and so he's entrusted with all your assets. And he must pay all your expenses and any lawful claims against your estate. He must arrange for payment of state and federal income taxes. A final income tax return has to be done in the year of your death, and there's all that good stuff that has to be done. And then finally, distribute your estate to the beneficiaries that you have chosen, and make a final accounting to the court for all receipts and disbursements. This is what an executor must do. Now, what about the probate process that he's going to go through? Understand that in different localities, you have different differentiations from county to county within a state, but these are general principles for the probate process. First of all, he must petition to admit the will to probate. then there is normally a hearing on the validity of the will. This doesn't need to be a long, drawn-out thing if you've done everything right. But if there are any questions, if you've amended your will, for example, I've met people who have just scribbled over their will. They've changed it. Well, they haven't changed it properly. You have to do things legally and properly. There's got to be two witnesses. Those witnesses and the testator or the testatrix must do so before a notary. Generally, we go for a self-proving affidavit so that everything is about what you can't just scribble in between the lines what you want to do. That might render your whole will invalid, in which case you are then intestate. Appointment of executor or administrator, and to send out notices to creditors of the estate. You look in the advertisement columns of the classified section of your newspaper, you're often seeing there advertisements that say notice to heirs or creditors and debtors of this particular estate. You are hereby given notice that 4 months from the second appearing of this particular notice, you must pay up or you must indicate that you are owed certain whatever it is in regard to the deceased. So there's that notice that has to be published. And then there's the collection and appraisal of assets. It's got to be done correctly and properly, because you're going to have to give an account to the probate judge who is going to be overseeing this particular estate. And the settling of claims against the estate. Make sure that there are no phony bills that come in. One of the first estates that I did a few years ago, a Christian couple who had been visiting the deceased before she died in the hospital, just a friend, and they came along and just were there, and they sent in a bill for more than $2,000 for visitation costs. Now, I ask you, was that a valid claim? Well, we're still working on that one. But we need to make sure that they're valid and we settle them. We've got to pay Uncle Sam both at the state level and the federal level. We've got all these things to do and then make the final distribution of the estate and make that accounting and get the approval of the probate judge in order to get everything cleared up. That takes time. And it's we'll be talking about a living trust in a minute, which avoids probate. But I do want to stress upon you that probate, while it's a word that we don't use in our general vocabulary, just if you think of title, take the word probate and replace it with the word title. See, a deceased person can't write and hand over anything, can't change title that was in his name. An executor or an administrator of his estate has to do that. And what you're really doing is changing the title of that estate, of the assets in that estate, to the beneficiary. And it's a good process. Probate is designed to make sure that your will is carried out. The only problem with probate is that it is sometimes a little bit lengthy and it can be a little bit costly. And so there are other ways to avoid probate if you have the right people at the right time doing the right thing. There are some will substitutes. Excuse me. Some of you may say, well, I don't really need a will because all my property is jointly owned with my wife. That's good. You promise me that you're not going to die at the same time as your wife, then fine. Everything is jointly owned. Provided it's a non-taxable estate. If you have a taxable estate, and a taxable estate as of this first day of the new year will be $625,000. Up until for the last, for a number of years, it's been $600,000. Many of you are acquainted with that break point. But for the next 4 years, it's going to go up by $25,000 per year. So in 99, it'll be 650, then 675, and I think it takes 9 years, and it'll be up to $1 million. And then if you have an estate under $1 million, you will not be in a federal estate tax situation. So if you've got jointly owned property, and your property or your total assets, including life insurance, remember, including anything maybe you like your 401k savings plan or an IRA, all of that is added together. If it's more than $600,000, while you won't be paying, or $625,000 now, you won't have any tax to pay when, because it's in joint tenancy with your wife. Nevertheless, you want to provide through will or through the trust a provision so that you can both take advantage of the marital of that deduction. Because you see, I can give my wife $1 million. But there's an unlimited marital deduction. But if Uncle Sam will never die. He's always waiting for the second to die, and then that's when he collects. Each one of us has this $625,000 exemption. So together, we can shelter in a credit shelter trust, using the credit shelter trust, we can shelter $1,250,000. So, I don't suppose I'm speaking to too many people in this room that you're concerned about that, but nevertheless, you need to think it through because of inflation and the increase in investments today. Will substitutes jointly owned property will avoid probate, and it is a will substitute. Life insurance is like a will substitute. You don't need a will. It's your beneficiary that you have appointed will receive the proceeds of that life insurance policy. Also, trust. We retitle our assets into the name of a trust, and avoids probate. It's a will substitute. And then contract agreement, I can come in to make arrangements for it. But again, it's subject to state law. In each case, you have to examine state law. We'll go on to the next slide, Drew, please. And what are the problems with joint ownership? Everything in the garden is rosy. Everything's in your wife's name or husband's name, as well as your name. You say, I don't need a will, and so I can just get on and don't worry about dying, because everything's taken care of. Well, joint ownership has some problems. We really do lose control of the other half. That's fine if it's husband and wife. But what if it's sister and sister? What if it's aunt and niece? What if it's someone who's not within the family unit per se? We actually lose control of the other half. And in fact, we may unintentionally disinherit our other family members. We divide, I might have six children, only have two, but I might have six. And I say, I'm dividing my estate up six ways. But then one day, I'm in a strange mood and I take one of my CDs out of the bank or I go to the bank manager, personal bank officer and say, would you also put that in my one son's name? What have I done? I've given him an additional amount. I have now not given things evenly to my children. And we can also disinherit our family if we put everything into joint ownership with other people. Also, if in joint ownership, if the other owner is sued, you could possibly end up being sued as well. And creditors, of course, could attack the other owner's share, and you could lose it. You think it's your money, and it's only going to be that other person's money when you die. Well, sorry, you've already given that person one half, and if that person goes into bankruptcy, for example, or has financial difficulties, they can take that money now. And then, depending on the type of joint ownership, it still could go through probate. Joint ownership or joint tenancy with right of survivorship is one thing, but there's also joint ownership where you have tenancy in common, and that will still go through probate. Depending on the asset and depending on your goals, then you work out the joint ownership differently. And it's also possible, and I want to stress this, because this is a very common thing that happens in the states today. People give their assets or put their assets in someone else's name or jointly with themselves. And there are unfavorable tax ramifications. For example, I may have a piece of property that I paid $20,000 for, and it's now worth $100,000. And I give it, say, to my son. I say, well, son, once I die, you just take that over. It's yours. Well, you say, that's a brilliant idea. Then it doesn't go through probate. And there's no problems. All he has to do is present the death certificate and get the title changed so that his name alone is on the title. Well, that's a great idea, if that's all you want to do. But the day will come when my son wants to sell that property. And guess what? He's got huge capital gains tax to pay on that. It would have been better for me to leave that property to him in my will or through my trust. Why? Because what we have in the Internal Revenue Code, what we call a stepped-up value, so that you take over, you inherit the assets at the deceased, at the value at the time of death, when the person dies. But if you take it over during his lifetime or her lifetime, you've got a problem because you're going to take over his or her tax basis, and then you will have a capital gain on which you have to pay tax. There are unfavorable tax ramifications. I always get very nervous when someone says to me, oh, I've got everything in joint tenancy. If it's not their spouse, I get very nervous. It's a very dangerous way to go. It can work, but be very, very careful in that regard. I want you to make a special note of this page. If you get nothing else out of this seminar, take this page home and say to your wife or to your husband or whoever you're counseling with, this is what I have to do. I need to consider, and I'm not saying you need to have, but you need to consider a revocable living trust and secondly, a pour-over will. Now, if you're not going to consider those two documents, then just replace them with a standard will. Just say, I need a will, or I need a revocable living trust. We'll be looking at revocable living trust in a minute, show you the advantages of that. But you should also consider having a living will. A living will is a directive, an advance directive, to your physician, saying, I don't want to be kept alive on life support. Please release me, let me go. Don't plug me into respirators and all that and keep me alive. You remember the famous Karen Quinlan case of years ago. A living will. You should consider that. I'm not telling you that you should have that. I'm just saying consider that. It's a personal decision on your part. A durable power of attorney for health care or a medical power of attorney. Durable meaning that it endures any period of incompetency. When you can't make decisions, health care decisions for yourself, who will? Who will? And particularly if you're single, then you want to make sure that you have nominated someone to make those decisions for you. And in that regard, you may want to consider certain levels of comfort or care so that the decision isn't always that attorney, in fact, that friend that you are asking to handle your affairs. In other words, do you want food and water when you're in a coma? Or you say, no, that's just keeping me unnecessarily alive. I have a reversible coma. I'm in an irreversible coma, and I just want to go home to be with the Lord. So don't even give me food and water. Just give me pain medication. Make sure that I'm comfortable. And talk these things over with the people that you're appointing. I find a lot of people just nominating people and not sitting down and discussing with them what they really mean and what they really want. A durable power of attorney for health care. And then a general power of attorney can be durable as well, which enables a person to handle financial matters when you can no longer handle them. Those are five estate planning documents that I want you to really think through as a good Christian steward. We're going to talk for a moment on revocable living trust. Some of you, I know, because you've spoken to me personally, have asked me about the advantages of a revocable living trust. First of all, you will hear that it avoids probate, mostly. Some of the states in America are starting to clamp down on
a lot of the misuse and abuse that has taken place with revocable living trusts, and they're making it harder and harder, I think, for Florida in particular, where they're making it harder and harder to make this simple document accomplish what you want it to accomplish. Privacy. A will is a public document. It has to be registered at your county courthouse. If you have any snoopy neighbors that want to know how much you were worth or who you're leaving your funds, their money to, it's public. They can go down and find out for themselves. Any reporters can go down there. And I don't know if any of you have been in a situation where after a certain family member has died, you're suddenly getting calls from insurance people or financial professionals or so on. They get sales leads, if you please, from the courthouse as well. It's public. Maybe you want some privacy. You'll have to go with the revocable living trust in that regard. There can be time savings. We mentioned that there is a period of advertisement that has to take place in probating a will. With a living trust, that is often not the case, and you can wrap it up pretty quickly. There's a continuity in periods of disability or incompetence. I know a man who didn't care about publicity, but he wanted to have this particular situation work for his advantage. Continuity in periods of disability or incompetence. I can hand over my affairs to my successor trustee while I'm still alive. And I can see how he or she is managing my affairs, so I can check, as it were, before I die. Once you're there, you can't check up on your executor. But with a revocable living trust, you have that advantage. It's a little bit more difficult to contest. It's still contestable. If it can be proved that there was undue influence, if there was any arm twisting, if you weren't competent in doing what you were doing, it still can be contested, to be sure, but it's a little bit more difficult to contest. And you can still eliminate federal taxes with an AB, that's the credit shelter trust. However, please understand, a revocable living trust is not designed to pay income taxes. Your income tax will be exactly the same. There's no other income tax form to fill out. You will fill out your normal 1040 here in the United States. The characteristics of a revocable living trust. First of all, who are the participants? There's the grantor, that's you. You are granting title of your assets to this trust. You're donating them to your trust. And someone's going to manage those assets for you. That person is called a trustee. Or you manage them yourself. Generally, you do that. And you are your own trustee. And then when you are no longer willing or able, your decision or because of death, you hand over to your successor trustee, who acts very like an executor or an administrator, if it were a will. What are the terms? First of all, you've got to set out the trustee's power. In other words, this document has got to be carefully prepared. Don't run over to the stationers, please, and fill in the blanks with some of these trust forms that you can pick up for a few pennies. Don't do that. I encourage you, don't do that. Seek good legal professional advice. A charitable giving history. You may, as I trust you are, in the habit of giving to the Lord's work, when you are incompetent and but still have the assets to give, who's going to give for you? Through your revocable living trust, you can ensure that it's done. It can also be done through a general power of attorney, provided you have the attorney, in fact, has been given that power. Don't take the chance if you haven't been given that specific power. A joint trust with you and your wife, you don't have to have separate trusts. You can have a joint trust, particularly if you're not a taxable estate. If you are a taxable estate, there's differences of opinion, let's put it that way, in the legal fraternity as to whether you should have separate trusts. But you can have a joint trust, and then it can be irrevocable upon death. Why would you want it irrevocable or irrevocable upon the death of one of the spouses? Or just in case the other spouse wants to get married again. You want to protect your children's inheritance And so you want to make that trust irrevocable so that the new fellow that comes on the block and he can't take any of your hard-earned income and go and give it to this kid instead. Just one final conclusion on the characteristics of the living trust. When it's all over, it gets distributed in the same way as wills distribute your assets. The living trust with tax planning. Let's have a look at some of these diagrams that we have here. I'm still searching for my pen. Anyway, we've got Bob and Sue. They have an estate that's worth $1.2 million. Pardon me if I'm shooting a little bit high here. Most of us are nowhere near this. I understand that. But in order to illustrate what the advantages are, I need to go this high. Here we've got $1.2 million, Bob and Sue. Now, when Bob dies, there is an irrevocable trust. Bob is in the blue there, and he has the B trust, and Sue is still alive. She has the A trust, if you want to call it that way. A for above the ground, B for below the ground, if you want to remember it that way. Sue can take all the income, well, most of the income. She can live out of Bob's trust while she's alive. She lives out of her own trust, and then she can take whatever she needs for an ascertainable standard of comfort and care and so on. She can take that out of Bob's trust. But technically, she doesn't own the assets in Bob's trust. And so what happens after Sue dies? Sue's $600,000 goes to the beneficiaries, the kids, the Lord's work, whatever. And Bob's trust goes also to the beneficiaries. But Bob's trust avoids the estate of Sue. So therefore, both have taken advantage of the $600,000 that is available, and now it's gone up to $625,000 as of today. Let's look at Mr. Black. Mr. Black has an estate of $800,000, and he wants to leave all his funds really to his sister's children. He doesn't trust his sister's children, his nephews and nieces. He's going to give it to his sister, and then his sister's going to leave it to her kids. On an $800,000 estate, assuming 5% for administration, we're looking at costs of about $40,000, and state tax of $16,000, and a federal estate tax of $53,000. And so the sister only receives $690,000. So about $110,000 has gone in expenses and taxes. Now, that's quite a lot, as you will agree. And then when she dies, there's further costs and further estate tax, and so the children out of $800,000 only get about $627,000. This is based on the exemption of $600,000. But Mr. Black attended Rise Up and Build conference, and he heard of a good way to plan his estate. And so he decided that he would create a trust. And not a revocable living trust, just a trust through his will. And so he still has those $40,000 worth of costs. He could whittle that down, and he could even negotiate with the legal people who are doing this. Yeah, they are negotiable, folks. You can negotiate with your lawyer. Don't just pay whatever he says he's going to charge. He's going to put $500,000 or $600,000 into a trust for his sister, and he's going to put $200,000 into a charitable trust, if you please, for the Lord's work. But his sister is going to receive all the income out of that trust until she dies. And then there's further costs, and her children receive $554,000, and the Lord's work receives $200,000. So that's $754,000 fine. A whole lot of money has been saved, and the Lord's work has benefited considerably. That's a single person's estate. What if we go to a married person's estate? If they don't use a trust, they have an estate, again, we'll go a little bit high to show to illustrate this. They have $1.5 million in the estate, and there will be costs. And so after the estate after costs would be worth about $1.4 million. And we keep on going until the second spouse dies, it's passing to spouse, and we keep on going, and we have further costs, and the children receive $1,025,000. Almost $500,000 has been spent in costs and taxes this way. So the children only receive $1,025,000. But again, this married couple attended Rise Up and Build conference and decided to change things. They wanted something to go to the Lord's work, and they wanted more to go to their children and less to Uncle Sam. They think Uncle Sam's got enough money. They've paid their taxes throughout their lifetime. They don't want to pay them again. That's what estate taxes is. It's a double taxation. You've paid tax on everything you owned. Now Uncle Sam wants to tax you again, and he wants to start at 37% for the first dollar after the exemption. And it goes up to 55%, and then it can go even further if you have IRAs and that sort of stuff, and it can go as high as 85% if you were really far up there. So there's the $1.5 million estate, and you have the costs and the estate after costs. Now, this is without a revocable living trust, which may be able to reduce some of those costs. And a charitable trust of $200,000 is also prepared, and there's a trust for the spouse and a trust and a direct gift to the spouse. And so you'll see that it's split up with correct estate planning. And we have further costs when the second spouse dies, and then we have 1.193 passing to the children, and we have $200,000 passing to the Lord's work. Now just think back a moment. The previous page, how much was going to the children? $1,025,000. Now how much is going to the children? Almost $1,200,000. Almost $200,000 more going to the children, and $200,000 going to the Lord's work. I ask you, did we put another $400,000 into the estate? No. We just rearranged things correctly. And who's paying for all this? Uncle Sam. And he doesn't like us talking about this too much, but the fact of the matter is he has prepared the laws that encourage us in a very real way to give to the Lord's work. So there's a way in which this can happen. Charitable remainder trust, type of trust, is probably the preferred way of giving for believers who have sizable estates. And I want you to understand the beauties of this type of trust. It's an excellent way of giving to the Lord's work. There are two types of charitable trust. One is an annuity trust, and the other is a unit trust. An annuity trust gives you a flat dollar amount. When you set up a trust, you put $100,000 into a trust, and you want, say, 7%, and if it passes the test, you can get 7%. It's actuarially computed to make sure that you pass certain tests. There has to be a minimum of 5% payout, and depending on your age, you may get 7 or 8 or 9%, but there's a flat dollar amount. So if you got, say, 7% throughout the rest of your life, assuming the trust doesn't run out of money, you'll get $7,000 throughout for the rest of your life. It has to pass the 5% probability test. It's a little mathematical equation that the IRS has come up with, and you're not allowed to add to it. And, however, it does give you some high deductions. You're giving money away, but you're retaining an income. But even in that situation, Uncle Sam is generous enough to give you an income tax, a deduction off your income taxes. The other kind is a unit trust. The dollar amount varies because the trust is revalued every year, and additional contributions are permitted, and you can have certain fancy language in your trust that gives you net income with a makeup provision or whatever. You can't ask now for more than 50% back per year. Who would ever want 50% back? Well, there's lots of people that do these things that have not charitable intent. They only want to dodge some taxes. And so the IRS has started to tighten up on this. So the remainder trust. We'll go to the next slide. What can they do? They can increase your income. Yes, you can donate an asset that is bringing you in very little income to a trust. The trustee sells that asset and then gives you income that you never had before. It can increase your income. It can provide tax-free income. It can also avoid, and generally, if it's an appreciated asset that is donated, it avoids capital gains tax. And it can provide you with some big deductions as well. And, of course, if you've given it away, you can avoid probate on those transferred assets. They can still be brought into your gross estate, however, but then you get a charitable deduction as far as taxes are concerned. That's what charitable remainder trust can do. The participant or the grantor, that's you. You are the grantor. You grant $100, which is an asset, or preferably some appreciated stock or mutual funds or real estate or something like that. You're going to donate that to the trust. And then the trust is going to pay you income for life, depending on what you've been able to work out and negotiate with the trustee. And then when you die, the Lord's work gets whatever's left in the trust. With good management, is that $100,000, depending on how long you live, could be $200,000 or more. And so you enjoy income for life, and the Lord's work collected upon your death, and it avoids generally the probate and hassles of that asset going through your estate. That's what charitable remainder trust can do, and that's a simple form of it, but it is a document probably 6 or 7 pages long, and it has to be done properly. IRS has got model forms for you, and it shouldn't cost too much to prepare these forms here. What can they do? They can increase income, and Drew, I'd like to flip through this very quickly. We've talked about the assets being donated, producing little income, and so the trustee sells the assets and invests in income-producing investments and can provide tax-free income. Just keep going on those. We'll go to the next major slide, please. Now, I want to just stop there for a moment. Administrative considerations. This is not for the faint part. This is not for the do-it-yourself type of person. And do get very good professional, legal, and tax, and investment advice when you're setting up a charitable remainder trust, because there are a lot of pitfalls there, and you don't want to end up with IRS on your back saying that your trust is no longer qualified as a tax-exempt trust, and they can levy some very stiff penalties if you do it wrong. You certainly don't want to be giving debt-encumbered assets to a trust, and you want to think through the type of trust that you want. Go to the next slide, and I have a statement here. Don't unwittingly disinherit your heirs. Use a wealth replacement trust, or what is known as an LIC, a life insurance trust. You're giving an asset away to a trust. The Lord's work is going to get that asset when you die. You've just disinherited your children, haven't you? Yes. But you can, with that income that comes to you, you can take a portion of that and donate that to a life insurance trust, and the life insurance trust, the trustee, purchases a policy on your life, and look what happens. When you die, the Lord's work gets what's in the charitable remainder trust, and your heirs get what comes to them through the life insurance trust from the insurance policy. So everybody wins. The kids are happy. They still got what the asset was worth. You are very happy because the Lord's work has received the asset, and you've enjoyed a good income for life. That is an excellent way, and that diagram right there, I make special note of it because that is an excellent, excellent way to go. And we don't have to talk about hundreds of thousands of dollars. I know certain institutions that would have $100,000 as a minimum, but, ask if they have a $10,000 or a $20,000 minimum, and you can enjoy this type of planned giving. There's a Q-tip trust. We won't go into that in any detail, but you can pay further taxes or postpone taxes that have to be paid through a Q-tip trust. Next slide, please, Drew. Just a note on the federal and state taxes going from 37% to 55%. There is life insurance is a great vehicle. We'll flip through those slides quickly, please, Drew. And there's different ways in which you can give to the Lord's work using life insurance. And then the final slides here relate to a charitable gift annuity. It's like a mini trust, but it's a very simple way whereby you just give the Lord's work a certain amount of money or an asset, and then you retain for life the income according to your age. This has nothing to do with having to pass certain probability tests. It has to do simply with your age. And according to your age, and I think I have a slide after this for a single person group that indicates what kind of rates are payable. I have an illustration of Mrs. Green. I'll just stop there for a moment. With Mrs. Green, she has certain assets, and she buys a $50,000 charitable gift annuity. She replaces a CD that she had at the bank. And without the gift annuity, her income is only $1,912. She's 84 years of age. But with the gift annuity, her income is $4,800. She's given her money away, and yet she receives a lot more in return. Provided she never needs the principal, because this is irrevocable, as is the charitable remainder trust, it is irrevocable, and she finds that her income is 251% higher, and I think one of the last slides we have indicates the annuity rate. We have run out of time for me to talk. I want to take some questions. We have a distinguished member of the legal fraternity here with us from St. Louis, Mr. Jenny Keller. You will straighten me out if I have said something wrong. I've always appreciated Jenny's counsel. He's a fine Christian brother, and I've appreciated him over the years. But maybe you've got a question or two that we could address here. Yes, sir?
You're saying life
The life insurance policy doesn't pay you anything, and it pays out to the life insurance trust when you die. But it's the charitable remainder trust that is paying you an income for life. So you're getting an income there, and you're taking a portion of that income and donating that portion to a life insurance trust. The trustee of the life insurance trust, he takes that donation and he pays the premium to the life insurance company. When you die, the life insurance trust will receive the proceeds of the life insurance, and then the trustee will distribute it to your heirs. So everybody gets a slice of the pie. Okay? Yes, sir.
If you're single and you figure you don't need all the income tax, you give now a third of your estate to your relatives to give right away. What will that be for that?
You are limited to giving $10,000 per person per annum.
Per annum.
Per annum. That's going to be increased with inflation thanks to the Tax Reform Act or the Tax Relief Act. I don't know how they can call it relief, but there were 1,109 changes The first sentence was 209 words. I don't know how they call that release, but in terms of new legislation, that will be increased. You can give it away. If you're just giving away cash, that's one thing, but if you're giving away appreciated securities, be careful, because your heirs will end up paying the capital gain when they sell it. And you can do that through your lifetime until you've exhausted the $625,000. After that, then you start paying Uncle Sam his portion. And of course, you would have a gift tax return to fill in every time you do that as well. Yes, sir.
It's something you heard from the Bible, brother, that would assure me that the judgment seat of Christ, I'm going to be rewarded for money I leave to relatives who possibly don't need.
No, I thought you were going to ask me a different kind of question. Yes, you will be rewarded, but I don't believe that you'll be rewarded to relatives that don't need it, particularly the relatives that will squander it, or unsaved relatives. I don't think that's prudent stewardship. 1 Timothy 5:8 says that if we don't provide for ourselves and for those of our own household, we're worse than the unsaved. So provision is one thing, but how much is enough? If you gave your son $50,000, that'd be very nice. You could pay off the mortgage on his house. But what if you gave him $150,000? What would he do with that extra $100,000? The scriptures are very clear that money easily earned or inherited is soon dissipated. And we don't have examples in the scriptures, but I think you will be held account for that. If you know that your relatives are going to squander it, why would you give it to them in the first place? To avoid a lawsuit? They threaten you a lot. Don't get scared with threats. There's very few wills in reality that can really be contested if you've done it while you were competent. Wait until you've got Alzheimer's, and that might be a problem. But while you're competent, it shouldn't be a problem. And if it's done properly, yes, ma'am. Yes. No, it's donated at fair market value. Yes. In fact, I've just been through one of those. This gentleman in California donated a house, and he bought it for like $10,000 or $15,000 in the proof of that. But in California, San Diego area, it was worth $150,000. He gets now, he asked for 8%. He gets 8% on $150,000. So that is an excellent asset to donate to a charitable remainder trust. But until you avoid all that capital gain, if you were to sell it to something that is virtually totally depreciated, you would have massive capital gains tax to pay. However, the capital gains tax rates are coming down, and that's great. More questions? Behold, today is the day of salvation. We really have to do these things today. We don't know about tomorrow. And so that's why the urgency. Let me say one thing about Canada. How many of you are from Canada here? Wow. My apologies for just assuming that most would be from the United States. Canada, Revenue Canada, has an excellent program for you as well. And I know Missionary Service Committee is thinking seriously about providing a service of this nature. And I hope to be helpful where I can be in this regard. But Canada has everything that I've talked about here, except the tax implications, but all the vehicles can be used in your estate planning in Canada. It's just that capital gain is realized, but it's half what it used to be. It's only 37.5%. It used to be 75%. But your tax credit, when you give to the Lord's work, you get it right off your tax. It's fantastic. You're getting 45 to 55% off your taxes and getting Canada's got a great deal for you. And I do encourage you to get on with some planning there. The state may have a better capital gains situation, but you have some, you're better off in the current giving side of things as well. So I do encourage you. I have a book on Canadian plan giving that comes to me shortly, and I can share, if you ever want to contact me, I'll be glad to share that with you as well. Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Hypothetical. I am worth $3 million. Everything is good for me. My wife, we won't get out of the plane crash. What's going to do that? Problem?
Very much, sir. You have a will, though.
Yeah. Hypothetical.
Yes, sure. Well, make it 33 now.
Oh, 33
now. Certainly, you would have a federal estate tax problem. And that some of it could have been avoided of that tax. Yeah, you certainly you have a major problem. If it's just a standard will without provision for trust, you know, it's the laws of your state will determine that you die first, maybe, and then your wife will go from you to your wife. So Uncle Sam collects here, and then he collects there, and there will be considerable reduction shrinkage in your estate by the time it gets to your heir. So if you have 3 or 33 or 133, you know, do some planning. Yes, sir.
In case of being delayed, you're obviously granted the most of the money to spend the remainder of the next 23 years. So how often do you get a widow or a living son rewritten?
Well, if it's just a simple amendment, you go with a codicil with a will for an amendment, with an actual amendment with a living trust, I would say every 2 to 3 years you should review what you want to do. That would be a rule of thumb. And as you get older, you might want to reduce that. I have people who, their ink is hardly dry, and they want you to change it again. Well, that's okay. I mean, that's the beauty of a revocable living trust or a will. You can change it at any time. And it doesn't cost much to change it. But I can't stress upon you the importance of getting competent legal and tax advice. Don't just accept what respond to an ad in the paper, people who are selling living trusts for $2,500 or that. Don't do that. Get good advice. And do it. You can come to a seminar like this and walk away and say, well, you know, it sounds like a lot of work. Well, it is, to a certain degree. And there's certain decisions that only you can make. But you've got to do it. And I encourage you to do it. Yes, ma'am. Yes. So it can't be too much help in a specific instance, but, well, thank you for your attendance. Appreciate your attention here. Lord bless you all.